Welcome to Groundwire Community Radio News, brought to you by volunteers at Canada's community radio stations. This edition of Groundwire was produced at CKUW on traditional Anishinaabe and Métis territory in Winnipeg, Manitoba. And we're your hosts. I'm Shkelzen Miskichi.
And I'm Sarah Aronson.
I haven't finished my treatment and I need to finish it. If I don't finish my treatment as it should be done, I could die in 1 or 2 months.
My name is Michelle Teske from Barrio Lake, and I'm an elder supporting my community in their struggle to preserve their identity.
We see the damage that is occurring upstream from our community, and this has detrimental effects to our way of life in future generations to come.
In this edition, Algonquins of Barrier Lake resist clear-cutting in their territory, the CBSA deports a woman in the midst of receiving chemotherapy treatment, and the chief of Athabascan Chipewyan First Nation expresses concerns about the expansion of bitumen mining on his territory. But first, here are the headlines. Southwestern Energy has packed up and left Elsapugtug First Nations territory for the time being. After many months of campaigning and direct action, fiercely protecting the land and water, Mi'kmaq people and their allies will have a break for now. During the week of December 1st, resistance intensified again as a burning tire blockade was set up along Highway 11 in the vicinity of where SWN was conducting the last of its seismic testing. The American company, SWN from Texas, has been conducting seismic testing in the area without prior and informed consent by the First Nations people of the unceded territory. The company has stated they are finished their work and will not return until 2015. SWN has intentions of conducting exploratory drilling upon its return. Elsapugtug War Chief John Levy was quoted by APTN stating, "We went through a lot," he said. "We need some time for this to sink in and think about everything. Think about what we went through. People did a lot of sacrificing." Several members of the Mi'kmaq Warrior Society, Aaron Francis, James Pictou, Jermaine Bro, and Cody Stevens continue to be held prisoner at the Shediac Detention Center, while SWN has packed up and left the RCMP are continuing to arrest Mi'kmaq people. Malcolm Ward was arrested on December 11th.
Deepan Budlakoti, a man the Immigration and Refugee Board of Canada is seeking to deport to India, a country he has never lived in, based on misinformation about his parents' employment status in the 1980s. On Friday, November 1st, 2013, an Immigration and Refugee Board judge ruled in favor of removing many of the strict conditions that had been imposed on Deepan over the past 7 months. Despite this victory, Deepan's movements are still limited and is still struggling with the reality of having been made stateless in his own homeland. News Now, Ayushi Sharman speaks with Deepan about his threat of deportation.
Now we know your recent hearing was held on November 1st in Ottawa. Were there any changes brought into your case through the trial, hearing?
Yeah, during that detention review hearing, I had a lot of conditions taken away, and now I'm with a couple of conditions left. I have to reside with my new sureties. I have to sign once a month. Mm-hmm. I have to keep the peace.
Okay.
And cooperate with CBSA, Canada Border Services. These are my conditions that I have now. Prior to this, I had strict conditions, 99 curfew, had to sign in every 2 weeks. If CBSA gave me a letter in 48 hours or 24 hours, I had to provide them with documents or be there within 24 hours. Had a hard time working, so forth and so forth. Now I have a lot of my liberty under the Constitutional Act has been given back to me, but still a lot of my liberty is still taken away from me.
Mm-hmm. Now, what made them take off some restrictions from your everyday to day life?
Well, there's a lot of factors. One of the factors that the judge, RMB judge, found is that Canada Border Security Agency is hiding documents from me and my legal team,
mm-hmm.
withholding documents that I should be getting, and another factor was that through access to information, documents have come up showing that India has confirmed that I am not an Indian citizen and will never ever be issued any type of Indian documents.
Okay, so you can never go to India?
I can never go to India, correct. And then another document came up showing that the former High Commissioner's letter signed by the former High Commissioner confirming that my parents did not work before him as of June 12, 1989.
All right.
Therefore, the law does not apply to me, and therefore I am an automatic citizen by birth.
For more information, you can check out www.justicefordepan.org.
A press release by Migrante BC is calling for permanent residency for temporary foreign workers. Recently, it was reported that Richard Pepito and Heidi Kibanoff, who were hired under the Temporary Foreign Worker Program to work at the Tim Hortons in Fernie, British Columbia, were being exploited by their employer. They say that their employer, Pierre Pelletier, took advantage of the temporary status and that he regularly forced them and other workers to give him back the overtime pay. Jane Ordinario was quoted in the press release by stating, Tim Hortons has brought in thousands of workers under the TFW program, and many are from the Philippines. It's shameful that a company that markets itself as Canada's national brand is raking in profits on the backs of TFWs who are treated like modern-day slaves.
Ontario will be reinstating health coverage for refugees in the new year. Back in June of 2012, the federal government made cuts to health coverage for refugees. Ontario is the latest of several provinces to step up and ensure people seeking refuge in Canada have access to health care, including Nova Scotia, Manitoba, Saskatchewan, Alberta, and Quebec. Nikki Bozanoff, a physician and Health for All member, stated, "We are very happy to see that Minister Matthews has responded to community mobilization on this issue and has worked to fill the gap left by the Conservative government's refugee health cuts. However, we also know that there are still many migrants left without health coverage in Canada, and we have a long way to go before our health care system is truly universal."
That is it for headlines. We'll be right back after this.
This is not my house. This used to be my home. Counting every stair, the creeks I've come to know. Go on, take it all.
Heard Home is Where My Heart Is by Don Amaro. Now it's time for our feature stories. On International Human Rights Day, December 10th, a 47-year-old woman undergoing chemotherapy for stage 3 ovarian cancer was forcefully deported back to her native country of Mexico. CKUT's Aaron Lakoff brings us the story of Evelia Castrellon Santoyo from Montreal.
Just days prior to her deportation, Evelia Castrellon Santoyo, who lived in Canada since 2007, pled with Immigration Minister Chris Alexander to use his discretionary powers to grant her a stay in her deportation, at least until she could finish undergoing her chemotherapy treatments for ovarian cancer. Her demand was supported by Marjolaine Boutin-Sweet, the NDP MP for Hochelaga, where Santoyo was living, as well as several other women's and migrant justice groups in Montreal. Instead, she was detained by Canadian Border Service agents, escorted to the airport, and put on a plane back to Mexico on the morning of December 10th. The day before, the Federal Court of Canada had refused her appeal for a stay of her deportation. Santoyo insisted that she would not be able to find quality, affordable health care in Mexico for her cancer treatments.
I haven't finished my treatment and I need to finish it. If I don't finish my treatment as it should be done, I could die in 1 or 2 months. At home in Mexico, this treatment isn't free. I'm very afraid to be deported because if this happens, it will take a lot of time before I can get treatment because they will have to redo all the tests and diagnostics, and it will cause a delay that could put my life in danger.
Santoyo spoke to the media at a press conference on December 6, a significant date to mark struggles against gender violence in Montreal and around the world. During the press conference, Santoyo, a survivor of gender violence herself, made reference to the anniversary of the Montreal massacre.
I wanted to remind everyone that today is December 6th, and it's a sad anniversary of December 6th, 1989, when 14 women were shot dead at the Polytechnique College. I'm thinking of them today, and it's very unjust the way that we as women experience violence. I want it to end for all women.
Santoyo was deported despite the community support she had received, which included a letter-writing and call-in campaign to Minister Alexander's office. In other related migrant justice news, on the same day of Santoyo's deportation, around 40 activists with the group Education Without Borders occupied the office of Quebec Education Minister Marie Malavoie to demand that the provincial government overturn a policy which effectively bans undocumented migrant children from accessing public schools by imposing crippling fees. They were removed after a few hours by riot police. For Groundwire, this is Aaron Lakoff reporting for CKUT Radio in Montreal.
Last spring, the Quebec government issued login contracts to several large login companies for the 2013-2014 year without meaningful consultation of the Algonquins of Barrier Lake. This clear-cut is in direct defiance of a trilateral sustainable development agreement signed in 1991 by Canada, Quebec, and Barrier Lake, as well as another agreement in 1998. On December 3rd, Algonquin people of Barrier Lake shut down the clear-cutting. On December 9th, a land protection encampment was erected to stop clear-cutting of Algonquin cultural sites and wildlife habitat. Lillian Bakhtar from CKUT Montreal spoke with Michael Thusky, an elder of the Barrier Lake community.
My name is Michel Thusky from Barrier Lake, which is about a 4.5 hours drive north from Montreal. And I'm an elder supporting my community in their struggle to preserve their identity against the forestry companies and the government.
So you found out in the last few weeks that there is a logging company that is planning to cut trees on your land without having respected the agreement. Can you tell me who the company is, what they're planning to do, and how the community has reacted?
Well, there has been some consultation, discussion with a different Native secretary at the provincial ministry, you know, who doesn't have the mandate to negotiate harmonization measures with our community. So we needed the Minister of Natural Resources to sit down with us and then get their commitment, both the Quebec government, the Marois government, to agree to go into a process to find ways to implement a co-management regime within our territory, and then also to make sure that, you know, the community's concerns are respected while allowing operation logging operation to take place. And these are the things, you know, that there is a lack of willingness on the part of the Minister of Natural Resources. They don't want to share the information. They claim that they done harmonization measure with the community, but we haven't seen any proof of that. Our community members are telling us they were not consulted, nor our leadership. So there's got to be a process, you know, that respects the Supreme Court of Canada, where the community needs to be consulted and accommodated. That's not the case in our community, so that's what we have to take this kind of action to get the provincial government respect the agreement and you know, discuss with us our concern.
Today, December 3rd, the community members took an action. Can you tell me what this action was and what was it about?
Well, the community members will just go back to their traditional hunting area, and then that's pretty much what's going to be happening. You know, if they're going to be logging operation, well, they can't do it because we're harvesting the area as well for subsistence use to provide for our family and our children. So the government has to wake up and consult with us and accommodate us, because we're going to be out there on the land too as well. You know, if there's a forced operation, it cannot take place because it's going to be too dangerous for our children and the community members. So something has to be done. We have to be consulted. We have to make sure that the implementation of that agreement is carried out and implemented.
How is the community being affected in terms of targeting by the Sûreté de Québec and other police forces?
Well, I guess for us, you know, we want to try to promote coexistence with the other users, but the provincial government, you know, is not listening to us. He doesn't want to listen to us. He doesn't want to acknowledge that we exist, that we use the land. And then it's unfortunately that, you know, it might turn out that we be criminalized by using our own traditional territory. It's criminalizing us for being who we are, of being raised the way we are now by our ancestors.
Algonquins of Barrier Lake are demanding that Quebec government honor previous agreements and cooperate with the community to identify and protect key cultural and ecological sites.
And now we'll go to an interview with Chief Alan Adam of the Athabasca Chipewyan First Nation by Native Solidarity News, CKUT.
We're going to be joined with Chief Alan Adam of the Athabasca Chipewyan First Nation. And to give a bit of background as to what's going on that side of Turtle Island. On Friday, the Jack Pine Mine expansion was passed, and the expansion would allow Shell to almost double the size of the mine from 7,500 to 13,000 hectares. And this would increase bitumen output by 50%, which is approximately 300,000 barrels a day. An environmental review, which was conducted last July, concluded that this project had, at that point, which had not been passed at that point, would result in, quote, irreversible damage, and recommended new protected areas to be established in order to compensate for this damage.
Right now, with what is happening in our area is that, you know, both from uranium development and oil sands development and every kind of development that has occurred on Lake in Alberta and in Saskatchewan is all being dumped into Lake Athabasca, where we reside in right now. And one of the most beautiful lakes in our view, because of the scenery that we have and everything that is there in abundance to wildlife and everything, is being deemed as critical at this point in time from our people, because we see the damage that is occurring upstream from our community, and this has detrimental effects to our way of life in future generations to come. If we do not protect it now, we won't have nothing. And right now, we could honestly say that probably Lake Athabasca, you know, it could be roughly 50% contaminated already as we speak. Basically, at this point in time, Jackpine Mine expansion is roughly around 205 kilometers away from the community, but then it's all upstream from our community of Fort Chip. And whatever happens on the Athabasca River flows down to Lake Athabasca, where we're at right now. And yet the government says that there's going to be some kind of adverse effects to the environment. It's acceptable.
Yeah.
And the reason why it's acceptable, because mainstream society does not are not affected by the whole project. You know, they deemed it as saying that $15 billion will be generated out of this project for the lifetime of this project. 750 permanent workers that will be there as well. Numerous contractors in and out of that area. We need fresh water as well, and we've been fighting for fresh water for our people, not only for our people alike, but for Canadian citizens all around, you know, in general.
Yeah, absolutely.
So not only First Nations are affected by the decision, it's everybody is affected, and we're just trying to say enough is enough. Let's slow this down and develop it in a sustainable way where we could get a grip on it and start cleaning things up and then work from there and see if we could progress and say we could do this in a greener fashion, more ways than one. I think they could just do anything they want because they have big, deep pockets whatsoever, and they have a big, fat wallet behind them that they control government levels at any outlet where they seem that they need to push buttons. But the fact remains is that, no, they can't keep doing what they're doing. They have to change their ways. And this is not only happening here in our region. This is basically happening right across this country to First Nations people.
This week, we bring you this report on a proposed universal bus pass for Winnipeg's university students and how that initiative is facing opposition from within City Hall. CKUW contributors Reagan Headley and Victoria King bring us up to speed.
In September 2012, both the University of Manitoba Students Union and the University of Winnipeg Students Association held a vote to ask students of their willingness to support a universal bus pass for students, otherwise known as a U-Pass. Results showed that students on both campuses wholly supported the U-Pass proposal, and so, in April of 2013, a motion was submitted to the Winnipeg City Council's Executive Policy Committee to fund the U-Pass. When the 2014-2015 draft budget was tabled in late November, student unions were disappointed to note that the budget did not include funding for the pass. At a city council meeting on Monday, December 16th, members of the Infrastructure Renewal and Public Works Committee made a motion to amend the draft budget in favor of the U-Pass. Representatives from UMSU and the UWSA and the Canadian Federation of Students also spoke to defend the U-Pass, as well as the proposed funding from the city of Winnipeg.
The UWSA was disappointed to learn that funding for the U-Pass program would not be included in the draft budget. This morning, I'm proud to lobby for an amendment to the municipal budget that would provide funding to the U-Pass program in the coming year, and hopefully set a precedent in the way that this council approaches input from its citizens. The benefits of the program would clearly be felt across the city. This program would get 9,000 transit users heading into the
core. My name is Rory John McLeod. I work as the Vice President Advocate of the UWSA. It's so rare that we get in these types of even small politics relative to national politics or provincial politics. It's really rare that we get community groups standing up and saying, this is our idea, help us out with it. Particularly on a scale such as this. I mean, the U-Pass is a $10 million program every year. And that's an incredible thing. You know, projects don't just drop off trees like that. We're talking about a bus pass for 30,000 individuals. I mean, this is one of the most exciting examples of progressive public policy being proposed, not by a city councilor and not by a city planner, but by citizens.
The benefits to the proposed U-Pass would include a more steady revenue to Winnipeg Transit and increased bus ridership, effectively causing more available, sustainable transport options, less traffic congestion, and increased bus ridership. While the pass would be partially paid for by students, it depends on subsidization from several sources, including the municipal government and Winnipeg Transit. As some members of City Council would point out, the demand on transit means a big increase. More buses, more drivers, more service to routes.
I mean, the issue here is transit saying that's not break even because we'll have to buy new buses and we'll have to add more staff. So in a way, it's, I mean, Ross had it right. I think there's a certain subsidy that would be required with the numbers as they are. And as I think Councillor Van Dahl pointed out at the time, when USB signs on or more grad student unions sign
Brian
on.
I'm Brian Mays. I'm the city councillor for St. Vitale Ward.
I think I have a point when I say, look, I don't know if it's the best public policy to subsidize all students at the expense of the working poor in Winnipeg. So how do you do it? Do you do it through the semester pass? I think we're looking at that, some other form of UPass. I mean, this is a classic case where the program, if successful, more universities, St. Boniface, CMU may want to join in, and then that's more buses, that's more staff we have to put on. It's kind of a victim of its own success. So I don't think anyone's ruling it out as bad public policy. It's just, okay, how much, what's the right amount to try and subsidize this? Because there certainly are benefits, but there certainly are costs.
The cost that was developed by the students doesn't take into account additional buses, additional staff that the city would have to hire. And I think some people who are working for minimum wage taking the bus might say, why am I subsidizing somebody who's in law school to ride the bus? They're not subsidizing me. So I think it's a balancing act in terms of, okay, how do you encourage students to get on the bus without asking some of the other taxpayers of the city to make too big a subsidy?
The other issue that doesn't get discussed is, if you start doing this, certainly the counselors are going to get a lot of heat, I think, from kids in residence and kids who drive and kids who walk and kids who bike. And they're going to say, I didn't know the referendum was on. And, you know, I don't think they're going to be satisfied if we say, well, talk to the student leadership. We're going to get, I think, a lot of heat. People need to be aware of that there's a lot of folks out there. If I lived in residence, I would say, why am I paying several hundred dollars a year to help subsidize somebody's bus pass? And it's a fair question.
You know, people who identify as any particular facet of society also identify as students. Students is an amalgamation of workers and mothers and children and fathers and daughters and any other category that you would look at in society, whether it's postal workers or fast food workers, or whether it's musicians or artists or the unemployed. And when we're talking about funding for things like the UPass, we're not talking about a student subsidy. We're talking about an investment in a group of people who are making an offer. It is answering that offer that we're asking them to do on Monday morning.
An update. On Friday, December 13th, the city's Executive Policy Committee decided that the UPass would not be added to this year's budget. Mayor Sam Cates added that he, Councillor Jenny Gerbasi, representatives of UMSU and the UWSA, are working on a motion for the new year, which, quote, will make UPass a reality.
Oh, 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 this song is my love letter to try and make the whole world better. We can't keep going down this road. It only makes this place a little colder when we carry hate on our shoulder. But we can learn to love if we let it go. We gotta be weightless, we gotta be hateless, we gotta be, it's about time for a wake-up call, there's a war in the high school halls, tell me how can we be so blind, the saddest story told is when a young boy 12 years old tries to take his own life. We got to initiate a change of state. Got to eliminate all the hate. We gotta be weightless. We gotta be hateless. We gotta be.
You just heard Hateless by Flo. That's it for this edition of Groundwire, produced at CKUW on traditional Anishinaabe and Métis territory in Winnipeg by Michael Welsh and Victoria King. Music this week was by Don Amaro and Flo. Headlines this week were written by Carly Forbes. We also thank Aaron Lakoff, Lillian Boktor, Native Solidarity News CKUT, and Reagan Headley. Tune in again to hear Groundwire on your local community radio station, or download at groundwire.ncra.ca. Groundwire is a project of the National Campus and Community Radio Association.